Kreisky-Forum Talks, der Podcast zur Stunde.
Thomas de Waal, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I know you just came back from a trip to the region, so it's a great honor for us to have you here now on this online video chat for Kreisky Forum in Vienna. Good morning.
Good morning.
You have been an expert for the Caucasus for years, and now we are in a situation where we, in a way, look at the end of the enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. Is that true?
Yes, I think Nagorno-Karabakh is over. It lasted exactly 100 years, and it's just ended, yeah.
What does it exactly mean? I mean, we had seen now about 100,000 people, Armenians, fleeing to Armenia. Is that sort of the big part of the Armenian population in the enclave? Who is left now? How strong is the Azeri repression on the rest of them?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically everyone has left. 99%, I would say, of the population has left and has very little prospect at the moment of going back. There was the Azerbaijani military operation on September the 19th, which was the kind of final nail for them, the ending. I think not many civilians were killed, but a lot of soldiers were killed. The Azerbaijani army arrived on the scene, and the civilian population, you know, they feared for their lives. They knew that there was no future for them in Azerbaijan as it currently exists. They left. So this is the end, not just of 100 years of Nagorno-Karabakh, which was a kind of autonomous region created in the Soviet times for the Armenians, but it's also potentially the end of a much bigger Armenian presence in this region going back many centuries.
But we have sort of, if we look at it historically, 1822, I think this particular region became part of the Russian Empire. So Russia has always been the power in the background, the power broker also, and also having an interest in a certain stability with like all these Caucasian republics, which were always potential unrest hotspots. So how does this play out for Russia now?
Well, I mean, Russia obviously has been the traditional kind of imperial overlord, protector and oppressor in this region. But Russia has also disappeared at moments. And that's the moments when conflict has erupted. So Russia is a kind of unreliable overlord for this region. So in the early 20th century, there was a lot of violence between 1918 and 21, when the modern map of the South Caucasus was basically formed by war, and that's when the Russian Empire had basically collapsed, and the local Armenians, Azerbaijans, Georgians, Abkhaz were kind of drawing the borders by force. Then the Russians came back, but in a kind of more different way, a Bolshevik international imperialist way. And established and reimposed order, but a kind of order from above. And then the Russians disappeared again in the late 1980s, as you know, with perestroika, formation of new independent republics when Nagorno-Karabakh was disputed between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And that was obviously the trigger for the next war. And since then, Russia has been a kind of the most important outside actor, but also, again, unreliable, switching between both sides, making promises to both sides, selling weapons to both sides, often a bit more with Armenia in the last few years, but suddenly we've seen this switch of allegiance. And the key thing why Azerbaijani forces were able to walk in, basically, to Nagorno-Karabakh on September 19th was a deal with Russia. The Russians basically stood aside. They had peacekeepers on the ground who did nothing. So it seemed to be agreed with Moscow in advance, this operation. So it's a switch from Armenia to Azerbaijan to be crucial.
And Can we see this as in the shadow of the Ukrainian war, that Russia just thinks, because it doesn't even really help the stability to let Azerbaijan take over Nagorno-Karabakh? It will create more problems, of course, in the future. Or why is Moscow stepping aside at this point, just because it's exhausted from the war effort in the Ukraine? Or
I think you're absolutely right. It's to do with the Ukraine war. A few things going on. Armenia increasingly frustrated with Russia. Armenia increasingly democratic and not seeing Russia as a reliable or long-term partner. Turning to the West, maybe rather too quickly, because Russia has forces on the ground there and controls much of the economy and the energy supply. So that's one factor. Secondly, Russia obviously losing capacity because of the war in Ukraine, and therefore downgrading its ambitions in the South Caucasus. It's no longer has the ambition to be in control of this conflict. It just picked a side, Azerbaijan, with whom it can work. Azerbaijan is another authoritarian state with whom they kind of speak the same language, as it were. Azerbaijan is also the route to the south. So it's the route down to Turkey, Iran, the Middle East, over land, over the Caspian. And so when Russia feels encircled by the West, Azerbaijan economically and in terms of transport becomes a much more important partner than Armenia.
There's actually this, you know, in the background of this is a very concrete plan for a transport route that goes across Armenia to the Azerbaijani exclave of Nakhchivan.
Yeah.
And that again sort of leads to Turkey. So there's a whole wider geographical aspect to this, which has the interest of Russia, Azerbaijan, and then also of Turkey. Can you explain a little bit how important this is?
Yes, well, obviously, because of all the wars of the 1990s, borders were closed, transport routes were blocked, which has really obviously inhibited this region enormously economically and in terms of development. So Azerbaijan has its exclave of, this again goes back to the kind of Bolshevik, the wars at the end of the Russian Empire, the Bolshevik map making. Azerbaijan has an exclave, Nakhchivan. It's kind of, it's Alaska, if you want, geographically, but not in any other way, which borders Turkey, but not Azerbaijan itself, but borders Armenia. And so a deal was struck in 2020, at the end of the 2020 war, between Russia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, saying all transport routes will be unblocked and a route will be built across Armenian territory to Nakhchivan. Now, the Armenians are not against this in principle, but they don't want to lose sovereign control of this route. What we're seeing now is a kind of competition between two routes. We're seeing two designs for the same route, shall we say. One in which Armenia keeps sovereign control, it's part of a broader international route, which also involves opening the Armenia-Turkey border. It becomes a route between Central Asia, the Caspian, and Europe, which goes via Azerbaijan and Armenia. It's a kind of cooperative route. Or we're seeing a kind of Azerbaijani, Russian, Turkish kind of plan for this route, basically to have minimal Armenian controls, Russian border guards in guarding the route, which benefits those three countries. Is Russia's kind of route to the south. Azerbaijan connects to Nakhchivan and Turkey, and Armenia has minimal control. So the West clearly now has a stake in this. They obviously want to see a more international route, but we're already seeing kind of quite threatening language from Azerbaijan to Armenia, saying you must open this corridor and implying on our terms.
But the development of the Azeri president, Ilham Aliyev, for years, of course, is autocratic. He's been in power for too long, as usual.
Years, yeah.
And so how can we even from the Western side expect anyone to reach him and to influence him? So what are the powers we would have to influence Azerbaijan itself? If Russia maybe steps back a little bit, there might be a chance for that?
Yes. Well, I mean, obviously, the international response to the takeover of Karabakh was, you know, critical, but not, you know, not super critical. This internationally was regarded as Azerbaijani territory. The Armenians too long had refused to kind of negotiate properly with Azerbaijan. And so although it was clearly, you know, in violation of this, an operation like this was clearly in violation of international law, you know, he's basically managed to achieve a fait accompli there, whether we like it or not. And I think it's a big tragedy personally. But obviously, if there's a threat to Armenian sovereign territory, this gets much more serious. This is, you know, analogous to Russia in Ukraine. So there's much more pushback against this. And obviously, there's, as I said, there's an international interest in having this route being international and not guarded by the Russians. So I think we're seeing pushback on this issue against Azerbaijani President Aliyev. Hopefully there's no illusions that he's a good faith partner whose promises you can believe. But there's another factor we haven't yet discussed, Tessa, which is the fact that Armenia is under huge pressure at the moment. Will Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan actually survive? And of course, if he doesn't, it becomes much easier for Russia and Azerbaijan here.
So how serious is this threat to his own political survival, and what would happen if he doesn't?
Right. Well, we're talking about a populist leader who came to power in 2018 on a peaceful so-called revolution, velvet revolution, a kind of Armenian Zelensky in a way, a kind of rather maverick figure, a bit of a loner, a very good communicator, but not a professional politician, really, who's made many, many mistakes, particularly over the Karabakh issue. But who is a Democrat, you know, who does and also clearly wants to emancipate his country from Russia. But he's under a lot of pressure because he's made so many mistakes. He's seen to be a man who helped lose Karabakh. This old sacred Armenian territory. And obviously the Russians are now openly attacking him. So there's the combination of angry Karabakhis arriving in Armenia, including, let me say, several thousand armed men who were the local army who just put on civilian clothes and moved to Armenia. So, you know, basically a small army, plus the Russian pressure, plus the fact he's made a lot of mistakes, you know, means that we hope there won't be some kind of military coup or something, but we have to be afraid of an eventuality like that. And this is obviously the kind of thing to be watching at the moment.
But if you say he made so many mistakes, I mean, what we saw is that Armenia basically offered on the negotiating table to Azerbaijan more or less everything that Azerbaijan wanted for the Nagorno-Karabakh situation to be stable and calm on the Azerbaijani terms. So what else could he have done?
The mistakes come maybe in the past that he didn't negotiate before the 2020 war. Or during the 2020 war properly, he could have saved a lot, and possibly Karabakh itself, by his stance. That he's not been very consensual, that he's kind of negotiated by himself and the rest of the Armenian elite feels rather left out. That he's rather kind of angered Moscow when Moscow, you know, clearly was in a position to betray him as it did. So those are the charge sheet against him. Having said that, I think a lot of people in Armenia are angry with Pashinyan, but they're more angry with Russia. So they don't want to see him removed by a Russian plot either.
I mean, are the Armenians looking more towards the EU now also for help? I mean, we have the situation that Ursula von der Leyen went in 2022 to Baku to get more gas from Azerbaijan, and we didn't hear very much from that corner in the run-up to this closing down of the enclave from the European Union side. Should Ursula von der Leyen have been more clear and outspoken about the danger of the Azerbaijani sort of way?
I think we've got a big... Well, I mean, we've got a big EU issue here, which is the EU trying to step up in the region from being a kind of technical, more political actor to being a more of a geopolitical actor, also filling the vacuum left by decline of OSCE, for example, in the region. And but then also the problem of different parts of Brussels with different agendas, the Commission wanting to kind of diversify energy supplies, and therefore von der Leyen going to Baku and calling Azerbaijan a partner to get some extra gas. I mean, we're not talking about huge quantities, to be honest. At the same time, Ms. Charles Michel on the other side of Brussels, the president of the council, negotiating, trying to negotiate a peace agreement between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And so clearly, Azerbaijan exploited that ambiguity. And again, with Armenia, there's now pledges of political support, financial support. There's also actually, we haven't mentioned that yet, an EU monitoring mission on the Armenian border, first such EU monitoring mission in a supposed Russian ally state. But clearly the EU, you know, it's not, it's still basically a political and soft power actor more than it's a geopolitical actor. It moves more slowly. The things it can offer to Armenia are more long-term, whereas what Armenia needs obviously is short-term stabilization.
Well, in one of the articles, you know, recently, of course, wrote a lot about the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh, and you had a clear call in your article for Carnegie that the EU must do more. So I wonder, as you now explained, there's of course different interests which are contradicting. As usual, you have to pick also who is the bigger enemy if you want to supply the European Union with gas. So could they have a much stronger message politically, maybe also to Armenia, in order to show that, you know, people who follow a more democratic route are also more welcome?
Well, I think obviously the EU can do a lot, but it's constrained by the consensus principle. Hungary, we're told, you know, surprise, surprise, has vetoed stronger criticism of Azerbaijan. Hungary, you know, likes working with these more autocratic states in the eastern neighborhood. And Italy is, I think, the major beneficiary of this Azerbaijani gas. Although Italy has also condemned Azerbaijan. But, you know, France is a big supporter of Armenia. So, but I think so the EU can do more institutionally, but I think we're looking at member states, in particular Germany, which I think is having a big rethink on its Caucasus policy, to be the ones to step up here.
Where do you think Germany can play a role there?
Well, I think Germany can be a one to offer more, certainly more financial support to Armenia, political support. We could, you know, maybe, I think the conversation has started about an EU membership perspective, but obviously that's a long conversation. You know, and but then US is also clearly a big actor here. So I think that what we're to watch for Armenia is one, support for Pashinyan, as much as you can give it to someone who's under this kind of pressure. And also trying to internationalize this discussion about the transport routes, take it away from Russia and Azerbaijan.
Yeah, the most concern, of course, we should always have is for the civilians that had to flee. And it's really pressing on our own conscience to think that this collective trauma that the Armenians, of course, have since 1915 and the genocide attempt by Turkey towards the Armenians is sort of course, with a development like this now, just being really rekindled and brought back to all these Armenian families who are now sitting thinking that it's always them who are being persecuted.
Right. Well, yes and no. I mean, obviously there's a massive trauma in Armenian collective identity, which is the 1915 genocide when, you know, a million or so, maybe more Armenians were killed and the rest fled their homes in what's now Central Eastern Turkey. But I think we have to be careful when it comes to Azerbaijan, which was not part of that, which was part of the Russian Empire at the time, where it was very much more 50-50, a war between two nations. And I think Azerbaijan also has its trauma because at the hands of the Armenians, because the war of the 1990s was terrible on both sides, but the bigger losers there were Azerbaijanis, who more than half a million of whom fled their homes. And so Azerbaijan for 20 years lived with this collective trauma. Both sides, of course, you know, the sad thing is that neither side healed their trauma. The only the way they healed it was by revanchism, was going back, was resorting to violence, as we saw in the case of Azerbaijan. You know, instead of sort of saying, okay, this is over now, we need to draw a page, draw a line under this, turn the page, you know, talk in a language of working together, you know, the Azerbaijani leadership now still has this very anti-Armenian rhetoric, excuse the sounds, I'm sorry, you know, and so the trauma continues now, and now absolutely it's the Armenians, this Armenians of Karabakh losing their homes who are the victims of another terrible trauma.
So what will happen to them? Because, you know, the Nagorno-Karabakh will be ceasing to exist by the 1st of January. That was announced by the Azerbaijani regime. So the about 100,000 people who now have fled, will they be integrated in Armenia? Is that something where everyone's clear about that, you know, the cousins will help, so to speak?
Well, I mean, what we're seeing, okay, I think many of them will be integrated into Armenia. Some of them may move on to other places like Russia. The question is, will they go back? Azerbaijan has unveiled its so-called reintegration project, inviting them back. And we have to be quite cynical here. Why didn't they unveil this before they used force, before everyone was forced to leave? And this will be, I think, the kind of next PR battle in which Azerbaijan says, well, you know, you're very welcome to come back as citizens of Azerbaijan. And the question really is here is that feasible? And my answer is no, under the current Azerbaijan. And Azerbaijan, which still has teaches hatred of Armenia in schools, and Azerbaijan, which gives its own citizens very few political rights, where has its minority rights, legislation is very weak. Azerbaijan, which has this big vertical power under the president, this is not a place where Armenians will feel safe to live. And you know, much of the population there has never lived under independent Azerbaijan. The last time they lived in what was Azerbaijan, it was actually the Soviet Union.
So that means they will stay in Armenia, as you say.
Maybe some will return.
Do we have to fear that they can't be integrated? I mean, is the population in Armenia?
They are Armenians. I'm sure they will integrate in some way or another. I don't think, you know, that it will be difficult, but I don't think, you know, they are after all ethnic Armenians. I think Armenia will manage that, but I think there's still political instability as a result of this very angry group of people, you know, who feel that the Armenian government let them down.
Thomas de Waal, thank you very, very much for speaking to us and for this analysis. Let's hope that the catastrophe is not sort of blowing up all the wrong regimes in the next month. Yeah. And we'll speak again. Thank you very much for joining us.
Let's hope so. Thank you.